Yeah, thanks. So that's an important thing. So everything I'm going to say is with this dichromatic. dot, dot, dot. With Manuel Behrens. Okay, so I'm talking about four-dimensional topological quantum field theories. These have been rather the poor relative of three-dimensional topological quantum field theories, for which there are a lot of examples and results, for example, related to the Resch-Tikhon-Tureyev or the Tureyev-Virov and its cousins, based on arbitrary fusion categories. In the four dimensions, we have the thing that was called the Krein-Yetter invariant. And that's long been regarded as sort of mildly interesting, but not actually very useful for very much. But I think actually that's possibly a mistake, and there is actually much more to be learned from the Krein-Yetter invariant. So I'm going to talk about how to reformulate it and generalize it slightly. So don't get too excited. We're not going to solve quantum gravity today. But I think it's a useful reformulation, and we have slightly more examples, and we see it in a slightly more general framework. And the important thing, which I think hasn't really been done, is to investigate the defects in the Krein-Yetter model. And that's something I'm not going to do today. But I'm hoping to perhaps excite somebody into working on this topic, because I think, you know, there could be some interesting things there, non-trivial things, possibly. Okay, so the Krein-Yetter invariant was first defined as a state sum model for the representations of UQSL2. And as usual, you take Q to be a root of unity. Which gives you a finite category, or finitely generated category. So, So this was then it was then realized that you could generalize this to a modular category, in general. Modular fusion category, should we say. And there's still a Krein-Yetter invariant. and in this setting, you always get that the Krein-Yetter of, let's call this C, Krein-Yetter of C of some manifold, four manifold, is some constant times some number to the Euler number of the manifold and some other number to the signature. So that's why it's often regarded as not very exciting, because it just depends on these two classical invariants of the four manifold. And then it was realized later on that actually there are some non-modular categories still make sense. An example is the, you know, fairly trivial example is the Dyck-Graff-Witten invariant. Where you just count the number of flat connections. Number of maps from pi 1 to g. Pi 1 of m, obviously. Yeah?
What do
you take the second cohomology, and it has an intersection form. And then you look at the, well, actually, with real coefficients, and you look at the signature, the intersection form. Okay, so you take two elements in here and integrate, and that's a quadratic form on this thing, and you look at the signature. Okay, number of pluses minus the number of minuses. So the various questions which we can ask, which is, can we have a sort of unified presentation of these examples? And are there more examples? Which the answer is yes. And the answer to this is the dichromatic stuff. And can we relate to physical models? Physics models. And so, for example, there are the Walker-Wang models, which are, in fact, sort of the Hamiltonian formulation of what I'm talking about today. So you'll recognize a lot of things if you're familiar with those. And the thing I want to talk about is the teleparallel stuff. Parallel gravity, this being a gravity seminar, I believe. So that's to keep you all awake to the end. Okay, so that's the introduction. Any questions? Okay, so I'm going to tell you about the dichromatic invariant. So C is a spherical fusion category. Spherical fusion category. And the spherical just means that the dimension of any module is the dimension of the same as the dimension of the dual module. And D, curly D, is a ribbon fusion category. Recall this means it has braidings, so there's an R matrix, and also there are twists for every object, like this, and satisfying all the right relations to give you invariants of knots, framed knots. And we want some condition on this ribbon fusion category, and we want the twist to be trivial on. So, trivial twist. This is the twist. So, on transparent objects. So, transparent means stuff that doesn't braid with non-trivially with anything else. So the. So D prime is the subcategory of transparent objects. Well, generated by the transparent objects. And transparent means that you braid trivially with anything else. So. So X is in that. If this is that for all y in D. Okay, so we have trivial twists on the transparent objects. And this subcategory D prime is going to play quite an important role in the following. So it's called the symmetric center of D. And in physics terms, it's sort of the things that carry the long-range forces in this theory, because they don't get tangled up with other stuff, so they can whiz off all over the place, roughly speaking. So this is a full monoidal subcategory, D prime. Okay, so we've got our C and D, and the next thing we want is a functor, F from C to D. And it's a pivotal functor. So pivotal means it's monoidal, but it also preserves the duals. So it preserves the monoidal and the duals. So that's our data for the dichromatic invariant. Okay, and then we're going to define invariant IF of the four manifold.
Yeah,
the
trivial. Like,
otherwise, they're separate, or? Yeah, that's right. So, by definition, the modular category is one for which D prime is just contains the identity object. Okay, and now I want to describe the invariant. Well, let's give you the formula first, and then I'll describe the bits and pieces. So this is the evaluation of L of omega D F of omega C divided by some normalization factors, which are the dimension of the category omega C, some power, dimension of omega D, the dimension of F omega C prime to the power H1. So all I've got to do is tell you what everything is in this formula. So L is a link diagram, which you get from the four manifold. And you label the components of the link with these objects, omega D and F omega C, labeled with omega D and F omega C, in a way you'll see in a minute. And this means the evaluation in the category D. It gives you a number, basically. So it's in the scalars for this fusion category, which you can think of as complex numbers. And I'll say more about this in a minute. I'm just giving sort of overview. And the bottom normalization factors are fairly trivial. So what are they? So omega C means you sum over the simple objects, so irreducibles, if you like. This means the simple objects. That's a curly C. You sum the simple objects and with weighted by the dimension of the object. So the dimension of the object means the evaluation of this diagram. Okay, which is a number called the quantum dimension of the object, and then you weight that. So this is sort of a virtual object, if you like, because the weights are not necessarily integers, but it still makes perfect sense. And what else? F of omega c means, obviously you apply the functor to it, so sum over x in lambda c of dx f of x, which you can think of as some coefficients times cy times y. So y are in the simples of d. And the coefficients gotten obviously by expanding f of x into simples in y and then adding up the corresponding d's. What else on the bottom? There's f omega the prime there, and that prime means you take the transparent part. So f omega c prime is the sum of over the y's in the in d prime of c y y. So it's just the transparent part, and d means take the dimension as before. So for example, d of this is obviously just sum of dx squared. Okay, dimension of that. Yeah?
So did you say what cy was?
Yeah, it's the coefficients you get by expanding f of x. See, f of x is what is it? It's just some object in D. And you expand that into simples, so you get some integer coefficients. And then you collect up all the coefficients of each simple object in D, obviously multiplying those integers with these D of whatever. It's just whatever that turns out to be. Okay, so that's all the boring normalization factors. And what are the H's? Yeah, so what you do is you have a handle decomposition of the manifold. Decomposition. Then. And you have HI handles. So these are just the number of the handles here, the powers on the bottom here. And then finally, I've got to tell you the important part, which is what is this link diagram. So this is what's commonly known as the Kirby calculus for four manifolds. So so a four manifold goes to M is turned into a Kirby diagram. Up to moves. In other words, you don't get a unique Kirby diagram, but you get a set of Kirby diagrams all related by moves. So it's like, you know, when you have a manifold and you triangulate it, there isn't a unique triangulation, but there's a whole set of them, but they're related by the pattern of moves. So it's the same sort of thing here. And you start with a four ball. B4. And then you add handles. And the diagram takes place in the boundary of this, so you have S3 is the boundary of B4. And what's a one handle? Well, schematically, a one handle is when you here's your four ball, and then you add You add a carrying handle there so you can carry it around with you. And this is, of course, an interval here, which I don't want to say, 0.1. But actually what we do is we thicken it up to make it a four manifold. So trivially, you multiply by B3, a three-dimensional ball. So it becomes a kind of cylinder here attached. Okay? So that takes you a new four manifold with a different boundary. And your diagram takes place in the boundary. So all it does is record what the boundary looks like. So you so your S3 is, well, you're drawing a picture of S3, which is R3 with a point at infinity added. So what you see is you see kind of spheres, sorry, balls, three-dimensional balls, which are the attaching ends of this thing here. So here I've got three-dimensional balls at each end of this. And that's what I'm drawing here in three-dimensional space. So here's two of them. Is this what I want to draw? No, I want to draw this. Sorry, I want to draw this differently. Start again. Yeah, so that was right. So there are my three-dimensional balls. I'm going to draw the diameters vertically. So if you've got a curve on this boundary, this thing here, you see a curve can run around on the rest of it, but it can also go up the handle and round there and back down and off there. So what do you see in the diagram? Well, you see a curve coming in here. And if it runs off the handle, well, you don't put the handle in the picture, you just see it coming out the other side again, running off that way. So here's another one that's coming in. Okay. So in this picture, these curves become discontinuous, which is a bit inconvenient, you see. So what you do is you think, well, let's just make these very close together. So I'm going to squash these together. And so what you do is you place that by, you push them together so they more or less meet. And I just put in the boundary, this diameter here, I just leave that in the diagram. But the rest I don't need to worry about. So this is a diagram for this process here. And so I've got two sorts of curve, the curve that were in my manifold here, and this curve that represents what's left of the one-handle curve. And just to make sure you know which is which, you put a dot on this, to the one-handle curve. So this is a picture of a one-handle. Okay, so that's the one-handle story. Now a two-handle, is attaching a disc to your thing. So I've got my...
So it's probably the diagram, is the circle with the dot, or the circle with the dot and the two curves?
So the circle with the dot represents the one handle.
Uh-huh. And, the curves
and these curves are just curves of the manifold. They're just drew
to it.
Sorry? They're not part of the information in the one handle. They're just random curves I drew.
Yeah.
Which you'll see why I drew them in a minute. So what's a two handle? Well, the two-handle is a disc. So you glue a disc on to this thing here. So obviously, when I glue the disc on, all I need to know is where the boundary goes. So I have the boundary goes somewhere. I'm going to do this. Gone wrong. Anyway, so the disc glues on, that's the boundary of the disc there. So you see, so the diagram shows the boundary of, so this is B2, and then you see the boundary of B2, which is a circle. embedded into the diagram. Okay, and of course, the whole point is this curve can run over the one handles. You put all the one handles on first, and then this curve, that's why I drew them anyway in the first place. So these curves here belong to some of the two handles here. These are two handle curves. So they can do complicated things, but they can also run over one handle. So there might be here a one handle curve. Okay. So there's your first curvy diagram. And there's a little lemma that says that for a closed manifold, then the diagram recovers the manifold uniquely. So diagram closed manifold goes to the same thing as the curvy diagram. So obviously you've got to add three handles and four handles, and the whole point of this lemma is that it doesn't matter how you add them, there's only one way of doing it. So all the information is in the one handles and two handles. Okay, so I end up with my link diagram here, and I label this with, as indicated, the one handles are labeled with omega D, and the two handles are labeled with the functor applied to omega C. So I wish I'd drawn this a bit bigger, but anyway, I'll say that again. This is labeled with omega D, and this is labeled with F of omega C. Did I say that the right way around? Yes, the right way around, yes. And now you see you have a link diagram in the three-dimensional space, and you evaluate that using standard category theory. Okay, so everything lives in D. D is a ribbon category. What does it say that? Yeah, ribbon fusion category. So any link diagram here will evaluate to a number. Okay, so that's what this means. Evaluation of labels curvy diagram. Yeah.
So with this curvy representation, any four manifold is represented as a link in three.
Yeah. So it does depend on which curvy diagram you use. So another lemma. It's independent of the choice. Handle decomposition. Is that a question?
Yeah. So at the beginning, you started with the four-pole,
yeah,
which has a boundary. So how do you get the closed pole manifold?
Well, after you've added the one and two handles, you still have a manifold with boundary.
Yes.
And then you add three handles and four handles to make it closed.
Right.
And this lemma says there's a unique way of doing that. So it's a little tricky. It says if you started with a closed pole manifold, and then take the one and two handles, then adding the three and four handles is, there's no information. It's a unique way of doing it. But if you just draw any diagram here, you may end up with something that doesn't make a closed four manifold. So it's not guaranteed, you can't just draw anything like I did here. That may not be a, actually it is, it's just S4. but it may not be.
So also the first lemma, closed M curvy diagram, that means maybe curvy diagram monomorphs and not any curvy diagram is your closed M or...
Yeah, that's probably, what should I say? Yeah, I haven't said that very well.
It's not exactly what you want.
Yeah, so closed M up to isomorphism. I So a curvy diagram up to moves. That's better. Yeah. It's a bit imprecise there. Yeah, so if you start with your manifold, you make the curvy diagram, you do this reconstruction of handles, it's isomorphic to what you started with. Okay, well, I'm not going to spend a lot of time showing it's independent of the handle decomposition, but I want to explain just very slightly why, do the important bit perhaps. And then when I do that, you'll see why the setup is the way it is with this functor and so on. Well, you might, I don't know. Yeah. Right, so shall I go here or shall I start again?
I would like to start there.
I could keep going around the room. Okay, so. This lemma here, it's independent of the handle decomposition, is you have to know what the moves are, and the moves are called handle slides. So you have handle slides. And what's a handle slide? It's where you have a curve for one handle and a curve for another handle, and then you can slide this over this, which means that you replace it with something like this. And that picture is a bit misleading because there can be a whole lot of other stuff going on in the diagram. So, in particular, there can be more stuff going through in the middle of that. So you can't just, if this was empty, it's a knot invariant, you could just slide it over. The whole point is there's a load of stuff in the way. And so it's a non-trivial statement. And the one that's non-trivial is sliding 2 over 2. Two handle over a two handle. So I'll explain this. So this is part of this lemma. So remember, two handles are labelled with objects in D obtained by mapping simple objects from C. So you apply the functor. So you have, this is a two-handle curve. And then I have another two-handle curve. I'm going to slide it over, this one here. So this is labelled by F of omega C. So obviously this is part of F of omega C as well. I don't need to worry about the whole of that. Just one simple will do. And then I want to draw some other random stuff through the middle. So this is some object A in the category D. In fact, there could be loads of lines going through, but one line is enough. And it could have one handle curves or two handle curves going through the middle. And this A is why you can't just slide this over like it looked like I could do on the board on the other side, because you've got to go past the A gadget. And so what you're trying to prove is the following, is that you can do that. So in other words, you can go to this is the lemma, and here's the proof. First, we fuse together this with this here. So this is fx, And this is F omega C still. And this is F omega C. So this uses the fact that you have a fusion category here, that C is a fusion category. So in C you can fuse stuff together. And so fusion means you can go from this to summing over the intermediate things here with some coefficients. That's the fusion process. So I've just done that. So what did I do? I did the fusion entirely in the category C, and then I F'd it. Right? So that's why you see F of omega C, because F of omega C contains all the symbols here. So, right. And there's some coefficients in these vertices, which I've just hidden. And then what do I do is I, and you'll notice that everything in this picture is in the category D, so I can pull these around the back here to the other side in category D. And that's where the break-in comes in category D, because I've got to slide under and over this thing. So this is equal to this picture here. So this is f of x. This is f of x. This is a. This is f of omega c. This is f of omega c. Right, so I slid all the stuff underneath. Mm-hmm. And now I can undo the fusion here, and that's equal to that. Right, fusion in C again. Okay, so this is fusion in C, this is sliding in D, and fusion in C. So there's no sliding in C, that's why there's no braiding structure in C. So it's all a bit counterintuitive, but you see in the formalism you label the one handles with D, you might think that that's funny because there are no crossings on the one handles, they're just simple loops. So you might wonder why you even need a category that has crossings there. And then the thing that does have crossings, you label with stuff in the category that doesn't have any crossings. So it's a little bit counterintuitive, but anyway, it works. That's the difficult one. The easy one is sliding everything over the one handles. So sliding one handle over one handle, or no, sliding over one handle over, no, two handle over one handle. They're easy because if you slide stuff over one handle, this is labelled with omega d, and everything slides over omega d, so there's nothing to prove practically. But the one you can't do is you can't slide one handles over two handles. And you see, if you can, then you've changed the four manifold, because this isn't a four manifold move, you see. You weren't supposed to be able to do this. And now you can appreciate the defect in the Krang-Nisher invariant. The original Krang-Nisher invariant had the property that you could slide one handles over two handles. So you could do this. But we're not trying to prove that. So that means that the Krang-Nisher is actually the same partition function for a lot of different four manifolds, where you don't want them to be the same. And that's why the Krang-Nisher invariant is very simple, or the original Krang-Nisher invariant.
So the Krang-Nisher is very good.
Sorry?
What is the Krang-Nisher in the context? You would label one handle or two handles the same way?
Yeah, so in the Krang-Nisher, well, quite got to that yet, but okay, yeah, so the modular Cragnetta. Since you asked, modular Cragnetta, you just put D equals C. And then you can slide everything over everything and it becomes too simple. That's the point. And F is the identity. So we've avoided that in our formalism. So any more questions before I about formalism generally?
So if you translate this back into the usual state sum picture where you have a translation of the uniform.
I'm going to do that in a minute, yes. So how am I doing for time? What should I zip on?
It's supposed to be...
Time. Well, maybe... If you go beyond 5 or 10 minutes, it's not a big problem for me. So
another thing.
We have the room is booked until 12:30.
12:30. Okay.
Unless you're going to lunch after.
Okay, so let me go to state sum models. So there's some results about this which I'm gonna I've done that. So I'm gonna miss out the results and go straight to module D. So this means there are no transparent objects in D. I is just a unit object. And in this case, you have the killing phenomenon that you can... There's another way of seeing why Handel's label with omega D are trivial, because you can always cut the strings. This is why. So the ij are bases of intertwiners, and the I upper j is the dual basis. And you do, and then you just have the dimension of this. This just falls off this ring, and you evaluate it and get the dimension. Okay, so this is the standard licorice killing lemma. And that explains why you can slide everything over one handle. Because on the one handle is at the circle leg with omega d. But you just replace it with this here. And then, of course, everything goes through the middle, and then you can glue it back again. So that's kind of trivial. So if I do this now, so now I'm assuming that d is modular, I can do this process here and replace my formula by sums over these intertwiners with the bases. And then you get your state sum model you wanted. So let's have the state sum model. What wouldn't work?
Getting the state sum model?
Yeah, so for example, an example of a modular thing would be... Oh, you mean
no,
the leader?
No, S2 is a group.
I'll come to groups in a minute, yeah.
It's not one of
the... Yeah, right. That's not modular, yes. Definitely. Hmm. Yes, so you can't take D to be the representation of a group. At least not with the trivial braiding. You might with the non-trivial braiding. Yeah, so what happens when you do this? Well, if we have our one-handle curve here, dot on, and loads of stuff going through the middle. Two handle curves, then this replaces them with an intertwiner here. And an intertwiner here. And these are these morphisms are in the D category, and they're maps from trivial object to fx1 to fx2, and so on. So this is fx1 down here, fx1. Labeling these. So if I do this operation, I get a new diagram. So the Kirby diagram goes to a new diagram. So the Kirby L goes to diagram K. Okay, where I've replaced every one handle curve with these. And this is your state sum model. Okay, loads of intertwiners, and so for example, if you start with a triangulation, so if you have a triangulation, so here, triangulation, you can go to a handle decomposition. Do this and then come back again and you get the state sum model for the triangulation. And then what you see is that the these belong to tetrahedra. These are your intertwiners on tetrahedra. And these are the lines which are dual to the two-dimensional faces.
So this is still a state sum decorated by both C and U.
So yes, that's right.
Yes. So can I think of C as decorating the edges and the faces, or the other way?
Yeah, so you have... try and draw this. So you have a four simplex will look like this. We'll have five of these things here, and then there'll be lines going to each of the other four. Yeah, and so on, etc. So these belong to these are the tetrahedra. Those are the intertwiners in D, and these belong to the triangles. This is a whole picture of a four simplex. Yes. So the tetrahedra are dual to the one handles. They're dual to the one handles. And these are dual to the two handles. And then what does your invariant formula, what does your formula look like? You just get some formula that's now I evaluate the diagram K of F, and then there's some normalization, which simplifies because D2 is modular, N to the H1. So N is the number of transparents that N is the dimension of F omega C, the transparent part, which is an integer. It's just the number of, because the only transparent things are the simple objects, so it's the number of simples that appears in omega C when you hit it with a function.
In this case where T is modular,
yeah,
one has the property of the one handle sliding over two handles. Is it invariant under this operation?
No.
No.
No, because C is not equal to D. No. No, no. This is still F of something in C. So no, you don't have the wrong sliding. Now the Crane-Yetta invariant, what is the Crane-Yetta in the most generalized form? You take F to be a full inclusion. A full inclusion. And D is modular. Well, D is modular. So what does full mean? It means that the maps on Hom spaces are isomorphisms. So C of, So if I have a Hom space, XY, then that's isomorphic to D of FX, FY. I'm saying this wrong, so my... FCXY equals. So generally for a functor, this will just be a subspace of this. But full means it's the whole thing. So all the morphisms. So the objects get restricted. You get fewer objects in C than D. But once you've thrown away the objects you didn't have, you have all the morphisms. And then what happens there is that these things here, in this Crane-Yetta thing, you can just calculate in C. So this is isomorphic to the C calculation of X. And all the calculations in, all those things evaluated in D, you can now evaluate in C. So what you have is that in the Crane-Yetta, IF depends only on C, with the ribbon structure from D. So remember, C didn't have a ribbon structure to start with. But now, all that's left of D is you can just transport the ribbon structure back and say it's a ribbon structure on C. So we say that this is the Crane-Yetta invariant of C. Crane-Yetta invariant of the ribbon category C. Wasn't supposed to be curly. An example is you can take.
By running D, I can get different functions on C.
Yes, that's right. You can.
So it
remembers. Yeah, it remembers that much of D. But if you think of that ribbon structure now as intrinsic to C, then there's nothing of D left. So if you think of C as a ribbon category, it's a slight shift of point of view, then there's nothing left of D to worry about.
And so all possibilities, is it, would I get the limit center?
Yeah, so for example, if you have a ribbon category C, you can always map it into the Drinfeld center. ribbon, say, goes into Greenfield Centre. So. So it always exists. So here's a couple of examples. So the Craniata of Curly C, of S1 cross S1 cross S2, is the number of transparents in C times the dimension of the category. But the Craniata of Curly C of S1 cross S3 is just the dimension of the category. And the point is, if you have more than one transparent object, these are not the same. But you wouldn't, so the original Craniata, the modular one, wouldn't see the difference, because these both have zero weather number and zero signature. So we definitely, you know, by going to non-modular C, we can see more. And so this gives you the state space dimension. In the T curve T is mod lambda C prime, or this is S1 cross S2, and it's 1 for S3. So this is exactly what you find in Walker Wang, for example. Here's another example. If I take the category to be rep G with a trivial structure, the trivial ribbon structure, then I get the digraph Witten. No, Craniata. So that's, you know, we have indeed unified all these things under one roof. Now I want to tell you about the teleparallel gravity before we have lunch. So there are various other examples, but I feel I ought to say something about this. So here's the setup. So phi is a homomorphism of finite groups, P to G. And of course, as such, you can factor through the image of phi. And it means that the induced functor on the representations goes the other way, rep G to rep P, factors through rep in phi. So there's two functors here, which I'm going to call A and B. And this is a restriction functor, and it's uninteresting. And B is a full inclusion. Okay, so B, you see, pulls back representations from here to here, and the representation here gives you one here by saying that the stuff in the kernel of this is acts trivially. And then intertwines up here, you know, the things that commute with the action of stuff up here, but they also commute with the action of things here because the stuff in the kernel acted trivially. Therefore, it's the same condition, so this is a full inclusion. Is that a question? So the invariant for this product of functors is just the invariant for F composed B. Turns out this functor here is trivial. I haven't said your F is. So F, yeah, you go into a modular category. This is modular. So I'm doing what I said over here. So I want a Krang-Netter model. So I want this to be full. So this is full and that is full. So of course, we're just looking at the Krang-Netter of this. Of rep m phi. Which is the Dyck-Graf-Witten of m phi. So it looks like it's, you know, it's fairly trivial. And this being finite groups, of course it is. But you can write a very explicit formula for it if you do a bit of work with the Kirby diagrams and so on. And it looks like the following. So you sum over some variables in P, and there's one variable for every one handle. And you form the product over the two handles of load delta functions. So that's just what you'd expect for a model to give you the Dyck-Graf-Witten invariant. But of course, the fun thing is that the homomorphism comes in. And then in the homomorphism, you put the variables that go around the two handle. So I need to draw a picture here. So you've got a two-handle curve here, and it goes through lots of one-handle curves here. And these have variables on them, PR1, PR2, and so on, all the way around. And that's this product here. So you product them around here, you get an element in the big group P, you then hit it with a homomorphism. In the little group, you evaluate the delta function in the little group G, and you sum up. So it's not quite looking at flat connections formed in this way, but it is if you look at the images in mphi, it is just flat mphi connections. Now, why is this remotely interesting? It's because there's a subject called teleparallel gravity. And in teleparallel gravity, just tell you a bit about that. And then I'll stop. Not like that, right. So teleparallel gravity. So this is due to Byers and Wise. Wise, John Byers. So P here is the Poincaré group. Of course, you're wondering why it was called P earlier. And phi is the homomorphism that takes P to the Lorentz group. And then the kernel of phi, let's call it n, is the translations. And what do Byers and Wise say? They say that the data for teleparallel gravity is a flat G connection. Okay, flat Lorentz connection. That's why it's called teleparallel, because you take a frame and you parallel transport it round flat, with no curvature. And of course there's torsion in this theory. That's the whole deal. But who cares? There's no observable consequences. And then you have a one form valued in the Lie algebra of n. Valued in the Lie algebra of n. Okay, so we ask ourselves, what's the discrete analog of this? Is it the finite group analog? Well, obviously, a flat G connection is a G for each one handle. And a relation product of G is the identity element for each two handle. And then what is a one-form valued in Lie n going to be in this finite group setting? Well, obviously the Lie algebra gets exponentiated up to group elements. And the whole point is there aren't any relations here. So this is n in n. Now which is the kernel of phi for each one handle. No relations. So we look over here, and so how does that relate to the data over here? Well, you can kind of see that it's the same as the data in this formula here for this sum. Because what does it mean that, because if phi of p equals phi of p prime, what does that mean? Well, it means that that p inverse p prime is in the kernel. So I can rephrase the summation here as, I can write this as phi p r1, phi p r2, and so on. I can sum this over the images here in G, that's the G sum. And obviously these delta functions are the relations in G. And now I've got to account for the fact that I'm not really summing over elements in the image, but I'm summing over elements in P. What do? I've got to sum over all the different Ps that could give me the same image. Well, what's that? That's just summing over the elements in N here, which is in this one form here. This is the sort of Cartan bit of the gravitational data. So I claim that this thing here is the discrete analog of this Byers and Wise teleparallel gravity.
This is still topological, right?
Yeah.
Would it be like teleparallel?
No, gravity. What? Gravity is topological.
Teleparallel gravity is not.
Yeah, that's my point. So, but this is topological.
Well, quantum gravity is topological, so everything's fine.
It's an infection.
So I like to say this to my people. No, it's true. I mean, if you do quantum gravity on the whole manifold, you integrate over the metrics. It's just, it's topological. I mean, it only depends on the topology. And here we see it.
So, but if you use this model, maybe how many states do you get?
I
Right, well, presumably what you're going to do is make the slightly finer groups bigger and bigger and try and make them infinite to get the Lie to sort of converge to a Lie group. And then these state spaces here will become bigger and bigger and converge to something infinite dimensional, and everything will diverge, and you'll have, you know, fun trying to make that work and make sense. But I bet something can be, you know, you can make something of it, I bet. So usually in these things where you replace the finite group by a Lie group, then not everything works. You know, some things are just horribly infinite and don't make any sense. But usually some subset of the calculations do work and make perfect sense. So you know, we see that in 2 plus 1, where you have the Poisson and Reggie model, and the partition function makes perfect sense for some manifolds and it's divergent for others. And there's interesting ways of saying how that is, and I'm sure we can do the same game here. I just haven't done it. Perhaps one of you guys will do it.
But then also the Poisson Reggie model says that in this sense you can have an infinite dimensional state, same as it's not still a topological.
Yeah. Right. That's all fine. Yeah. I mean, you know, the big problem with Craninietta was always that its state spaces were one dimensional. So if you take the modular Craninietta, that, you know, that's still true in this formula, and the state spaces are one-dimensional. So you could never, approximate gravity because you want to be able to make your state spaces get bigger and bigger. So that's hopeless. But here, you know, you can do that.
So do you know how much it helps? I mean, now, so my understanding is that so far there was almost no interesting four-dimensional invariants.
Right.
So how much can you now specify or classify for
dimensional topologies? So there are slightly more interesting ones here, but I don't think they go beyond the classical homotopy invariants.
Classical what invariants?
Homotopy. But as I said in the introduction, I think the interesting thing is the defects in these theories.
No, I agree.
Which, you know, is going to be non-trivial. So the fact that we just manifold invariants aren't very exciting to a topologist doesn't mean that there's no physics in
I agree.
In the theory.
So the defects, can one describe them also by Kirby diagrams, or is it?
Yeah, that's right. So you would...
the absence of 3 and 4 angles.
Yeah, so you know... So you can add in...
So 4 is a point and 3 is a stable.
So if you want to defect into a Kirby diagram, you can add in another line here, which isn't summed over, and that becomes a defect.
Ah, so that's easy, okay.
Yes.
Okay, then, thank you.
Yeah.
So we can start a big model.
Yeah, sure.
And is there any relation of this model with the higher categories that sometimes are suggested to be relevant for higher dimensions?
Yeah, so the question is, so if you have a spherical fusion category here and a ribbon category here and a functor, the suggestion is that you can now cook up some sort of higher category from this data. And I bet there is a construction of a monoidal 2 category with this data. I haven't seriously tried to do it, but probably, yeah, sure. So that would be a good project to try and understand that. So this should give you some slightly non-trivial monoidal 2 categories that we didn't have before.
Because didn't Laurent and Aristide have a model based on the Poincaré group, where it's also part of the states on, like, the edges are labeled by the translations?
Yeah, they had something like this. Yes, right. You're right. But I'm not sure it's the same. That's a good question. Yeah.
But a Craninietta, is the category seeded or non-modular?
No, it can be modular. If it's modular, then Craninietta is the original Craninietta, and it has the property that these state spaces are always one-dimensional, and you can You don't see the difference between two handles and one handles. So, so it's sort of less interesting. But yeah, so the new thing is the non-modular, you know, understanding how to put the non-modular categories into this framework.
Okay, so I think we can continue the discussion over lunch, and let's thank John again.